Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. Nearly 3 weeks ago, just about 18 days ago, a 7.8 magnitude earthquake struck the northern region of Nepal. Some 8,000 people died. Yesterday, another large earthquake, this time 7.3, struck and left dozens more dead, more than 1,000 injured, and questions about what's next for this already traumatized Asian nation. Coming up, we'll hear about how Ohio State glaciologists are using their technology to help with the rescue efforts. Joining us now is the New York Times South Asia Bureau Chief, Ellen Berry. Welcome to the show, Ellen.
Thank you.
So what happened overnight in Nepal or during this past day in Nepal? Do the aftershocks continue?
Yeah, what I heard is that there were aftershocks through the night. I think a huge part of the population is now sleeping outside. Over the 17 days after the first really big quake, people had sort of gradually gotten back to a normal routine, and a lot of people had gone back to their homes. But now I think the sort of fear is back in everyone's mind that there could be another really big one.
Right. How much workaday life returned to normal? When I read the accounts, it said people came screaming and running from office buildings, too.
Yeah. Basically, in Kathmandu last week, it was, except in the place in the historic districts where there were a lot of very iconic buildings that went down, you could walk around the city and not have a sense that anything, that there was a crisis going on. There were shops open, restaurants, and people were acting normal again. Out in the provinces, and especially in the mountain villages near the Chinese border, there are villages that where there is no house left standing, and people are basically living in ruins or under tarpaulins. Those are the places that may not recover anytime soon. But in the big cities, you could see that life was getting back to normal.
Do we know anything new about the missing American helicopter and its occupants?
No. Apparently, there has been a major search underway, both in the air and on foot. I have to say, though, having been up in the mountains in one of the most affected areas, that the terrain is incredibly challenging. It's high-altitude flying, and a lot of these villages are built on very steep inclines. I mean, it's sort of amazing to see that a lot of these villagers are farmers. They grow wheat, but they grow it on very, very narrow terraces that are cut into the sides of very steep mountains. And in a lot of these places, you can't see any place, any spot in the village where a helicopter could even land. So I think it's very challenging flying.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Coming up later in the program, we're going to talk with an Ohio State glaciologist about how they're using technology that they use every day to help map the areas in Nepal where the rescues are required. We hear about the onset of monsoon season, Ellen. What impact will that have? What are they bracing for?
Well, I think it's going to impact people both in the cities and in remote villages. I think what is particularly alarming about people who live in the hills or in isolated places is actually the roads just go out. They're impassable in some cases for 2 months. So there you begin to see the possibility of people running out of food and being stuck up there. Farmers that I talked to who were in the mountains said they had to make a decision right now whether they were going to plant their rice crop and, possibly jeopardize the food supply or try to rebuild their houses. So if they don't rebuild their houses by the time the monsoon sets in, then they will spend basically 2 months with no shelter from wind and rain.
It's an either-or proposition. You wrote recently that the countryside of Nepal already has lost thousands of young men who have left to work as laborers in India, Malaysia, or one of the Gulf nations. What's the upshot of the population that's left behind? What's the upshot on the who's left behind? Are there not enough young men to help?
Right. I mean, I think this has nothing to do with the earthquake and everything to do with what Nepal has been through in the last 20 years. But there are a lot of villages that are populated entirely by elderly parents and wives and children of men or children of women who have gone overseas to earn more money, mostly in the Gulf states, in Malaysia, and also in India. You know, the problem is you don't have young, strong people either to save those who are injured or to bring frail people out of danger, and now to rebuild dwellings in time to give people some shelter from the coming monsoon.
Is there any sense that they're trying to come back to help, or it's just not really affordable or pragmatic?
They are coming back to help. I mean, it's sort of noticeable that you see people, you see a lot of the migrant workers coming in through the airport, and that was true the day after the earthquake, that you just saw them walking down the airport access road with their rolling suitcases. I don't know how long they were going to walk, but people really, like homing pigeons, just finding their way back to their families. But it was also true that there were big numbers of people who were boarding planes for Doha and Istanbul, because I think it's already become a way of life in Nepal that if you want to help your family, the best way is by leaving them and wiring money back home.
Right. The tourist season, the tourism in Nepal is huge, and it's obviously going to be pretty much decimated for a while, right?
Right. Tourism contributes about 9% of the GDP, but it is one of the fastest growing sectors in Nepal. I think everyone wants to see the tourism come back, but right now, I mean, there's sort of a double whammy. One is that a lot of the most beautiful spots in Kathmandu were hit. I mean, Kathmandu in many ways survived beautifully both of these earthquakes. I mean, the loss of life could have been much worse, but some of the most beautiful buildings in the city are gone now.
It's hard to imagine the antiquity that's been lost.
Right. However, I should say that, you know, people who live in the city point out accurately that these buildings have all been rebuilt. You know, there is a history of terrible earthquakes in Nepal, and many of these temples, you know, were rebuilt in 1934. And, you know, people will say, we'll just rebuild them again.
The country of Nepal is too poor to manage this alone by a long shot, and China and India have been involved in much of the aid work. What's at play there? What's going on? Obviously, they share borders, but beyond that, there's a little competition.
I guess what's surprising is that in previous regional disasters, you just haven't seen China take a high profile at all, and this time is a little bit different. India has a long, open, and very easily accessible border with Nepal, which almost immediately supplied helicopters, which were the most urgent need for the government. So, I mean, that was sort of the major default rescue operation, and you can't, it's really not even comparable, except that the Chinese linkages and the Chinese engagement is growing year on year. They are now the biggest source of foreign direct investment in Nepal, and trade is growing year on year. Tourism is growing fast. In fact, in the Tibet Autonomous Region, I think they have a consulate that supplies more Nepali visas than any other consulate in the world. So you just see a very quickly growing relationship there.
I suppose ultimately having two big countries like that interested in you is helpful.
Yes. However, I mean, I think what is the cause of concern is that the UN's initial appeal for funds has met with a very disappointing response. So they estimated, I think, $423 million is what they were asking from, you know, wealthy international donor countries for the initial stages of recovery the first 3 months. And they've gotten, as of yesterday, they've gotten less than 15% of that. And that is despite what I would consider, you know, quite a lot of press coverage and you know, a lot of sympathy for Nepalis. You know, the people that I've been asking about this say that, you know, maybe this is just donor fatigue, that sort of Ebola and Syria and, you know, a series of other disasters have just worn out countries that are used to giving. But it is upsetting that, and that was, you know, before the second big earthquake, which sort of deepened the distress that the people are in.
Yeah, I read about that, and I was surprised as well, and I wondered if that had changed, because if you think about it, $423 million is a drop in the bucket anyway.
Yes. This is going to go on and on in Nepal,
right.
And, you know, there are going to be fewer and fewer stories in the international press about it because the situation is just going to be one that grinds on, that people are going to be fighting the elements and the weather, and they're going to be eating less. So this is the time when it has the highest degree of attention. And if the money isn't coming in now, mm-hmm. it's hard to know when it will come. I guess one thing that's interesting about Nepal that really struck me over the past week or so is that the community responses have been, especially in the cities, have been really, really vigorous, that people immediately came out and organized themselves to clear buildings and to find, to pull out bodies and to save the people that could be saved. And so those kind of grassroots responses seem to be very robust and vigorous to me. People out there have very little confidence in the central government. You hear that. You heard that really starting from the first day. The army has had a really good response and reached a lot of places, but people have very little faith that they're going to get the sort of food and shelter that they need over the long haul.
You wrote about an engineering student, Prakash Banjara, who was on an aid mission delivering rice to villages in one of the districts that was hard hit when the second earthquake hit, and they're trapped. I mean, are there a lot of people out there now trapped that were out trying to help and are now trapped themselves?
Well, I think there's a lot of roads that are shut now, and presumably some of them will have been cleared since yesterday. But, you know, to get to the worst affected villages, you have to basically scale mountains, and a lot of the roads are impassable for much of the year. I was in a village the other day, you know, where the road actually just was open to vehicles 3 years ago, you know, and so generation after generation has lived up there with no vehicle access at all. So those roads go out really easily. And I do think a lot of people got caught. Hopefully they are making their way down, you know, and to safety. The people who live in the mountains are used to it, by the way. I mean, they grew up that way. But yesterday there's so many medical crews, there's so many sort of foreign relief operations and so many ordinary people that went out to the mountains to help that, yeah, they ended up in the middle of this thing.
What do seismologists say about the prospects for yet another big quake?
Well, an aftershock is normal. Usually aftershocks are about one order of magnitude less. So that would have been 6.8, that would have been a kind of predictable aftershock. So this is bigger than seismologists would predict. And there is some, I guess, debate out there as to whether this can be technically defined as an aftershock. But my understanding is that most people are accepting that. I mean, I think what you begin to see is a pattern of earthquakes along a kind of axis in Nepal, where the 1934 earthquake and the April 25th earthquake and this earthquake were all in a fairly close range.
Mm-hmm.
I think what we're seeing in very slow motion is India colliding with the Eurasian plate. And how much energy is still pent up at different points in that fault, we don't know. But of course, that is a very important question for the people who are living on top of it.
Ellen Berry, thank you so much for joining us today. Appreciate your time.
Thank you.
That's Ellen Berry. She's South Asia bureau chief for the New York Times. Coming up, more on Nepal and the earthquake damage and how some folks are trying to help. This is All Sides with Dan Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Dan Fisher. Two recent earthquakes in Nepal have left more than 8,000 dead and thousands more injured and homeless. Disaster relief and emergency management efforts are crucial, but locating victims and getting to them can be difficult in the mountainous regions that were affected. Researchers at Ohio State University hope to ease those efforts with satellite imaging technology, usually employed to study glaciers. Joining us now in the studio is Ian Howitt. He's a glaciologist with Ohio State's Byrd Polar Climate Research Center. Welcome to the show, Ian.
Thank you.
Also with us is Andy Politz. He's an experienced international mountain climber and guide. He has been on several expeditions to Nepal and Mount Everest. Welcome to the show.
Thanks.
How can satellite imaging help the victims of these earthquakes, Ian?
Well, a place like Nepal doesn't even have an existing good map of the topography. And we just heard that the terrain there is some of the most extreme on Earth. And just trying to find a place to land, say, a rescue helicopter or to fix a road and understanding how to clear terrain or just understanding what the slopes are like in a village, they don't have that basic information. And that's just a function of being a third world country and not having the resources to do that. So we're employing satellite technology that's actually pretty new, and we've been using it in the polar regions because, like Nepal, the polar regions don't have very good existing topography. And, of course, we're interested in ice change and so the thinning of ice sheets and glaciers, and so that's what we're studying at very high resolution. But we realize that we can do this same thing for Nepal and give them adequate topographic maps so that they can plan the logistics of the rescues.
Andy Politz, for people who have never been there, can you kind of describe what Nepal is like, what you encounter when you've been there before?
There's not a whole lot of places for a football field.
Okay.
It's very steep on the whole. And as the previous speaker was talking about, in the monsoon season, that's the summer season, it's hard to imagine where all that water comes from and how intensely it falls out of the sky, saturating all the soils, and anything that's already been disturbed with all that moisture in it is going to slide as well. And that, typically every year it closes the roads, and they just drive trucks up to the road closure and porter the gear across the road closure and load it on a truck that wasn't caught, that was caught on the other side of the road.
Mm-hmm.
And that's one challenge they're up against. And then construction techniques are such low-tech. Instead of a oven-fired brick, they've got clay bricks that were just left to dry out in the sun, and they just don't hold up to seismic forces.
Ian Howitt, what are you looking at? So do you even know what you're looking at yet when you see it? Can you tell where the roads are? Can you tell where is it that high resolution that you can tell where someone's, if there's a structure there?
Oh, yeah. These are very high resolution data sets. These are down to meters, 2 meters. So you can see buildings. Almost all of the data we've been dealing with now are pre-event. So this is the lay of the land before the earthquake.
Oh, okay.
But now, so what we need to do is make a base map, a reference map, which didn't even exist. It was sorely needed, but this gave us the actual motivation to do it.
Mm-hmm.
And now, once we have that, we can start using data being collected now after the event to actually map change, like changes in slopes due to landslides.
Right.
And things like rivers changing their courses, that's actually happened. Things like building collapses, we will actually be able to map that. One issue with the monsoons, this earthquake was so extreme that it actually could change the topography enough to change drainage. So their whole agricultural system and this, the way they drain this enormous amount of water is dependent on the topography. And so when the monsoons come, they're going to have floods in places that they're not used to having floods. So that's another application of this data, is to figure out how that's going to happen.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about Nepal in the aftermath of two big earthquakes within the last 18 days. My guest's in the studio right now, Andy Politz. He's an experienced international mountain climber and guide. He's been to Nepal six or seven times. Also, Ian Howitt. He's an associate professor of earth sciences at Ohio State. He's a glaciologist, and they're using technology that they usually employ to study glaciers and study melting ice in the Arctic regions to study the changes that have occurred since these two earthquakes in Nepal to help rescuers, because they need to know what they're up against, and they can't see around the next mountain, right?
That's right.
Yeah. So how much time is going? Do you have to do this? What are you looking at? Am I taking you away from really?
Oh, well, I mean, this is something that it's actually brand new. We've just had the data for only a couple of years, the ability to get this data. We've only had the software for a year. This is software we've developed that actually can do this at a mass scale. And we need the supercomputing. We're generating this data using most of the capacity of the Ohio Supercomputer Center.
Really?
Wow. So
it's requiring that much.
Oh,
it's that big.
These are very data intensive, and that's one of the reasons we haven't had the data yet. There had to be the motivation to push this huge amount of data through. So literally the morning after the earthquake, my collaborators and I were talking about how we really needed to do this. And so I called up the staff at Ohio Supercomputer Center, who we work with, and asked them, hey, you know, can we do this? Can you give us some supercomputer time? And they were very responsive, and they basically gave us half the whole machine.
And when you say gave, meaning at no cost?
Oh, this is all at no cost. I mean, it just comes out of the operating budget of the supercomputer. So this is basically a gift from the people of Ohio.
And how – I was going to ask you, Andy Politz, about mapping in the areas that you've been in Nepal. You're familiar with that problem that so much is unmapped. But what you do in climbing and so forth, mountain climbing, there are a lot of maps for that, aren't there?
Yeah, and we also want to go to places that are unmapped,
okay,
unexplored. And typically Mount Everest has excellent maps made in Switzerland. So they're fantastic. Mm-hmm. But, you know, just from the kind of thing we're doing, we just need to set up a tent, be able to walk through an area. And that's fairly easy to see.
It's not you're trying it's to not, evacuate not hundreds the, of people or something
no,
like that.
No,
or
we
land
don't have litters. We're carrying people. And
yeah.
Not a real time demand on us.
How have maps like this been used to help other troubled areas that you know about? Is there any template for what you're trying to do, Ian?
They have been, but usually they're in places where they already exist. So, for instance, the United States, of course, is extremely well mapped. Mm-hmm. We have laser measured topography, so very accurate. So this is not an issue here. In any developed country, it's not an issue. So this is kind of standard protocol.
I'm wondering if they're going to find, Andy, much to suggest that the topography will change for climbers, too, that the mountains have shifted and changed.
Well, the glaciers are bound to be less stable through the Khumbu icefall. Apparently, they tried to descend off the mountain through the icefall and somehow we're unable to get down through it or to come up through it at the same time. Yeah, you know, as the earth heats up a little bit, the mountains are less stable. And
mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's a different game than it was 20, 30 years ago.
Ian, by the way, listeners, if anyone has a question or comment, I welcome your calls, 614-292-8513. You can also email us at allsides@wosu.org. Again, that number is 614-292-8513. Ian Howitt, can you see how detailed are these? Can you see where people are trapped? If there's villages, can you see people? Will you be able to?
You wouldn't be able to see people.
Okay.
You would be able to see with the imagery that we're using. So the actual photographic, they're satellite photographs, basically. They're very high resolution. They're up to 32 centimeters.
Which means what?
So that's about a couple feet.
Okay.
So you could see people on the ground with the imagery. But if, again, you know, these are snapshots in time.
Right.
So you're getting kind of data when there's not clouds, when you can, when the satellite happens to be going overhead. So it is useful for seeing damage for sure. And that's being done right now. In fact, I think there's satellite tasking over where the helicopter, the Marine helicopter that's lost, is trying to figure out where that helicopter is.
So they're using the data that you're getting right now.
They're using the imagery data that they're getting. Now, you have to turn the images into topography. That's okay. What we do. And that's what takes all the computing power. And that actually gives you a measurement of how the surface has changed. So a landslide, how much material has fallen, or if a building collapses, you could actually detect that change. We have the imagery, and then we also have the topography. And the topography is useful for these logistical issues we've been talking about, planning on where to land and changes in the structure.
Do you have enough data yet that suggests there's been a lot of change in the topography from these two quakes?
Well, there's other data that's much more general that says that there has been, that parts of the Himalayas either raised or shifted up to 6 feet, maybe more in some places. So this is a major event. And as the New York Times reporter mentioned, this is part of the plate tectonics at work in this part, which the reason the Himalayas are there are because of these kinds of events.
Right.
So this is just something that happens. It's part of the geologic process there. And so, there have been major changes to the land, the lay of the land there.
It's interesting to think about things changing, about where waters are going to be coming from, where floods will be occurring. For maybe generations, people have been used to one thing, and it's just part of their life. They live through monsoons every year. But, you know, this could be a whole nother set of problems.
Yeah. Got that.
What about climbers? Do you know anybody who was out there at the time?
Sure.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Have you heard from them? Do you know how they're doing?
No, I haven't heard from anyone. I'm sure they've got a full plate. Some folks are posting some photos from different areas they've been into of villages, sounds like decimated, just nothing, not a house standing. That's pretty striking.
When climbers are there, what would you do if you were there now? And I don't know if that's not necessarily trapped, but do you just try to get out of the country as soon as possible?
You see the full range,
yeah,
of human reaction. Some have gone off to the nicest hotel in Kathmandu and waited till their plane could fly home. Others have dropped everything they've done and done anything they can do.
Mm-hmm.
So you see it all.
There are the guides that go with a lot of climbers. What are they expected to do? Stay with the climbers or go off and try to help?
That would be a tough call.
Yeah.
Because you are responsible for your clients,
yeah,
on the hill. It depends on the resilience of the clients you're with and the need. And I would hope you'd be helping. You know, they all got flights off the mountain from the Indian helicopters, and I'm surprised that they actually didn't just get themselves off the mountain and let those choppers help people that needed the help.
Mm-hmm.
More so.
Hmm.
But, you know, I wasn't there, so what do I know?
Mm-hmm. Doing this kind of a project, Ian Howitt, what do you learn from it as a glaciologist? What is it? Is it something? There has to be something that you're learning from it.
Well, like I said, this is brand new technology,
right.
And I'd actually just finished several proposals doing this for glaciers on a mass scale. For instance, making a nice, a big, highly accurate map of Greenland and of Antarctica. But now we're finding ourselves doing it immediately for Nepal, and we're learning a lot about the techniques. We're learning a lot about the processing, developing our software. So it's going to be, it's actually a big help. And of course, once we have this data set for Nepal, it's going to be used for humanitarian and for people's benefit. But of course, there's going to be science, lots of science we can do with it. Suddenly we'll have maps, highly accurate maps of all these glaciers that are changing. And of course, as a glaciologist, I'm going to be using this data to measure that change.
Mm-hmm.
To understand what's going on with the ice and climate system there.
Well, I want to thank you for joining us today to talk about it. I appreciate your time, Ian.
Thank you very much.
Ian Howitt, he's an associate professor of earth sciences at Ohio State University. Coming up, we'll talk to a native of Nepal about their experience in contacting family and friends there after the two big earthquakes during the last 18 days. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. A 7.3 magnitude earthquake struck Nepal yesterday after another earthquake that shook the country a couple weeks ago. Between the two events, more than 8,000 people have died and thousands upon thousands are homeless. Disaster relief has been slow and frustrating as the death toll continues to rise. Joining us, still with us, is Andy Politz. He's an experienced international mountain climber who's traveled to Nepal on several expeditions. Joining us now is Sheba Joshi. She's a Columbus resident who was born in Nepal. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, Anne. Thanks for inviting me.
What do you hear from friends and family back in Nepal?
I mean, there's a lot of emotions, a lot of scare. I mean, they don't know what to expect. The first one hit, they didn't know what to expect. They all ran out. Whoever survived, survived. All my family is doing fine. But after that, numerous tremors have been hitting on and on. So they're just, it's just not safe to go back to the house. And whatever homes were left untouched by the first quake, the second quake hit it. And like, example, my husband's grandparents' house, the first time around, it was fine, but the second time around, now it's unlivable. My own grandparents' house has cracks all over the place, and this house was built some 100 years ago. My grandfather was born there, and so it carries a lot of sentiments when you think about it. You look at, you know, I have a lot of memories in that in my grandparents' house. So when I think about the fact that I go back and it's not going to be there, you know, that's a lot of emotions. Outside of that, you know, they're tagging the homes with color coding, red, mm-hmm. yellow, and green. The
like government. With spray paints yeah. or something like that, yeah.
And so the red means that, you know, it'll be demolished. Hopefully government assistance will be there to do that. And then the orange ones, you can go back in if when it's repaired or so. But with yesterday's earthquake, you know, we've been FaceTiming with my cousins, and they were just running out, you know, like, we have to rush, we have to rush.
You were FaceTiming with them when the quake hit?
We have done that several times since the first one hit.
With tremors
yeah.
and yeah, aftershocks,
and,
right.
And, you know, we're talking and all of a sudden something hits and they're all rushing downstairs. So, you know, with yesterday, think about the basic things you need to do in the morning, you know, like
yeah.
they're finding a place where there aren't a lot of buildings around. Because the buildings are made with thick bricks, layers and layers of bricks. And if it falls, not only it destructs everything around you, it could be life-threatening. So it's not safe inside. And with the densely constructed city that it is, it's not safe to be outside.
And we're
either.
Talking about Kathmandu?
Yes,
yeah.
ma'am. Mm-hmm. So, you know, they're finding a common ground where, you know, it's kind of open. And then they're rushing into the morning into their homes, trying to do some basic stuff, gather some water, and then go back to that same area so that they're safe. So life has been just upside down. And since the first quake hit, I know that some people were trying to get back on track a little bit, have weddings, like very low-key, without any music or anything, getting married on jeans. And, you know, they were trying to get back. I know, but the second one hit, and, you know, it's been very difficult. I know from talking to my family and friends that a lot of youngsters are out there trying to clean up their alleys, picking up rubbles themselves, trying to pull out people, find people. So there's been a tremendous community, you know, bond that has been built.
Yeah, Ellen Berry mentioned that from the New York Times. She mentioned that it's really extraordinary.
It's very extraordinary. And, you know, when I read about people from out of country coming in to help as volunteers, it's very emotional state. You know, it's very thankful. I know Nepalese people are very thankful for all the help they're getting.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about the aftermath of two quakes in Nepal within the last 18 days. The last one occurred yesterday. I'm talking with Sheba Joshi. She's a Columbus resident born in Nepal. If you have a question or comment for her, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. I suppose a lot of people, and I was to a certain extent surprised at the level of communication you had after the first quake. I thought that a lot of that stuff would have been inaccessible.
We thought the same thing, and we wanted to, you know, I have my cousins, my grandparents there, so we wanted to reach as many family members as possible, so mm-hmm. we were calling directly from our cell phones. I know internet was down and electricity was down for a while, but they were able to restore it like around 5 days or so. The electricity okay. came back in the main city. Mm-hmm. But, you know, trying to access the remote areas is still difficult. I mean, even on a regular day, trying to go to those places is hard.
Exactly.
You have steep mountains. I'm sure you can speak to that.
Yeah.
With just, you know, narrowly carved roads, one-way road, which is being used as two-way roads. And now add to that the earthquake, rubbles, all the landslides.
Right.
Only means to get there is helicopters, because you may not even have plane, you know, airports in these areas. So it's very difficult to get materials out there, help people.
Andy Pulitz and I were talking earlier, and I don't know whether you can respond to this or not, but we were talking earlier about how the guides, you know, the Nepalese guides that help the climbers, they have to be they must be torn about who they're going to, where they're going to go and what they're going to do. Do they stay with the climbers, with their clients, or do they go back to find their families and see if everyone's okay?
And, you know, in most cases, these guides, they have made personal relationships with their climbers.
Right.
They are returning climbers. I know a couple of my friends who go all the time to Nepal. So they almost know them as family. So they're going to try to do their best to help them and, you know, support everybody and pull them out of the situation.
And something else, I was talking to Ellen Barry about from the New York Times, and that is over the past several years, the exodus of so many young men from Nepal going to find, make more money somewhere else to send back to their families, but they're not there, and money
exactly.
doesn't help much right now.
Exactly.
You can't get to them, yeah.
There is shortage of manpower. My cousin who works at the airport, he was, firsthand, he'll tell us that there is tons and tons of materials that are being sent from all the countries, and in bulk
to help rebuild.
Yes, mm-hmm. and all these relief materials, they're dropping him off in the airport, and from the airport you need to take it to certain hubs, and from the hubs it goes to the relief area. So they're trying to catch up on the pace with that, but there's shortage of manpower. How do you get all these materials out there? And pieces and parts are, you know, smelling. So, you know, you have to really pick up the pace with getting relief materials out to the folks. And there is shortage of manpower, definitely.
What about your family in Kathmandu? Do they have enough to eat? Do they have enough to drink?
Yes, some of their homes, like my grandparents' house is cracked, but they have another house that they're moving into, but a lot of people are not fortunate enough to have that situation. Mm-hmm. One of my uncles is moving into our open apartment because his house is now down into rubbles. Some of my family whose homes are standing, they can go back in there, gather water for the day, you know, do their daily stuff, but they don't want to be in the house. They're not encouraged.
Right.
So they have to get in, get out really fast. And in that time, we get chance to FaceTime with them, Skype with them, and then find out that they're okay. And the next minute, you know, something else hit. So it's like one time they're fine. Next time you hear it in the news, another big quake hit or something. So it's a very scary even for us here. To think about that.
You mentioned you had a cousin who worked at the airport.
Yes.
I meant to ask Ellen Berry about the airport, and I didn't. What about that? How is that? That's got to be – it's still operating, so that's good.
It's still operating. He's an aircraft engineer there, so he's day in and day out there. But I think the priority earlier was on, you know, relief aircrafts and such. But I think commercial aircrafts have started landing. That's all I can say for right now, but –
The April 25 quake killed at least 19 climbers, Andy Pulitz and crew on Mount Everest. So what do we know about the remaining climbers out there? You said the Indian helicopters came and took most of them out?
Yeah, they're off the mountain.
They're all
working their way down or helping in the villages as they can, and every possible response is probably what you're seeing. You know,
right.
Some living the high life and others neck deep helping the people.
Right.
And everything in between.
Yeah, how did your family kind of create balance between just maintaining and getting enough to eat and drink and taking care of their life and then figuring out how to help others? How does that work?
You know, it's like I don't even know they have time to think because there are trimmers hitting on and on. They're just finding an open space to go and camp out for the day. And if they're okay for the day, that's a great day right now. And like you were saying, you know, there are some living the high life, some really helping out others. It's hard, particularly for small kids and old people like my grandparents. And earlier, I know you mentioned about the monsoon season, but I know that it was raining and it was damp out. So it's very hard for old people and, you know, those who have compromised immune systems. So I know the community is pulling very tightly and they're all together wherever they go. Like they go out together, they come in together. If there is an open space, they're lending it to them so they can stay for the time like we are doing. So whatever we can do.
And Andy Pollitz described earlier what it's like there. I mean, there aren't a lot of open spaces.
No. And the high-rise apartments that they have built recently, they're all cracked. They're coming apart. So I know some of my family members who had lost their homes, they were trying to go out rent and there's nothing available. So, you know, and people, we have heard news about people who have several homes. All of them are gone. So where are they going to stay, right? So they're really in the tents and camping out. So it's a different situation.
If you have a question or comment, we have a few more minutes left, so you can get your call in right away, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Needless to say, there's people who want to donate. They want to help. Do you have any sense about what people can do? What would you do?
You know, donation would definitely help. I would go to, there are several GoFundMe accounts that people have opened. I have a family member who has opened that as well. There's care.org, Red Cross, some UNICEF sites. If you go through those, you know, these are major corporations, international presence, so they will be able to escalate and distribute funds appropriately.
When it came to the call for international aid, I was surprised at two things. The amount. Nepal was asking for only $423 million, and that's just not a lot of money when you think about it. And then that only about 15% of that has been fulfilled at this point, which surprised me too. What is your sense about people's understanding of what's going on over there and how much is needed? 423 doesn't sound like a lot, but it is to people in Nepal.
It is. If it's allocated and distributed properly, you know, I think the loss, somewhere I heard, don't quote me on that, but it's close to $1 billion or even more than that. I mean, if you think about it, right now the need is, you know, relief materials like blanket, tent, clean water, stuff like that. When we pass this tremor phase, it'll be demolition phase, which is also massive because think about all the structures, cements and bricks, piles and piles of cements and bricks. To remove those, to clean the dead bodies, you know, that's a whole another task. And then thirdly, rebuild. So there's a lot of massive efforts that is needed to get back on track, and funds, I would imagine, going to be needed more than $1 billion or $1 billion. But again, the other question is, how are they going to allocate it with all the different political parties? And I'm not too knowledgeable in that area, but hopefully they'll be on the same page with what's the priority.
It is said that there's not a lot of reliance, and not a lot of people don't get a lot of comfort from the government there. It's not a very good government, not very reliable.
It's a lot of parties, but at the same time,
factions.
You know, right.
Okay.
I mean, it's a lot of parties for a small country like that, but, you know, with international presence, big organizations, and even people helping on their own, like GoFundMe accounts, you know, I think there will be the community bond will exceed anything else.
Andy Politz, did you have plans to travel to Nepal to climb again?
I was thinking of doing an expedition next year and somewhere else, and I just felt it's foolish to go somewhere when if there's a need to get some masons and some construction people, which is my background, and go to Nepal and do something.
To help.
And it's, as you were saying, it's going to be a while before that's even of any value. But you have to be able to go there knowing that food and water and shelter is in high demand, and you're going to take up some of that. And so you have to be so effective that as a volunteer, I'd be walking in there and taking somebody's food and water and shelter, I'd better be performing and getting a lot done. And that's the piece that we got to wait and see if there really is the need for that. It sounds like there's plenty of need. It's just how that gets organized.
And you know, I'm hoping that they will do the cleanup and getting back on track soon, because tourism is a very important industry for Nepal. I myself, I'm going in later this year with my daughter. She'll be going for the first time, and I have not changed my plans. So I'm, you know, standing still here saying that, you know, things will get back on track and hopefully tourism will get back. And that's very important for us.
Ellen Berry from The New York Times said that it makes up about 9% of the GDP, but that it's the fastest growing industry in the nation. When you were growing up there, when you were a child, do you remember tremors?
I do. Actually, I experienced one big one myself in 1987 or 88, something like that. You know, we had a close to 7 Richter scale earthquake, and we were very scared. I was a little girl back then, and we came out of the house. You know, it wasn't as intensive as this one, but I know there was loss of life. But we didn't have tremors after that, but the scare was still there.
Mm-hmm.
So I can't imagine, you know, people going through right now, you know, they have earthquake and continuously we call them tremors, but they are earthquakes,
right.
Really. Ranging in 4 to 5 Richter scale. So it's got to be very scary. It was back then for us with the 1 earthquake. So, yes, I have experienced that.
And what do you do in the meantime before you go back, if you go back? How are you helping or trying to help? What can you do?
You know, I've donated through various websites. Mm-hmm. That's the only way I can help right now. When I go back, I'm going to try to see if I can personally help somebody in need. Right now, we're lending our place to those who mm-hmm. need it, who don't have it. So those are the ways. You know, donations do help for those who cannot personally go there. And praying, and lots of praying.
Well, I want to thank you so much, Sheba Joshi, for joining us today. Appreciate it. And best wishes for all of your family and friends there.
Thank you very much for inviting me and your concerns for Nepal. Thank you, Andy.
Yeah, thank you.
That's Sheba Joshi. She is a Columbus resident born in Nepal. Also with us, Andy Politz, an experienced international mountain climber and guide who's been there several times. Thank you, Andy, as well.
You bet. Thank you.
Thanks to the All Sides staff, my producer, Michael DeBonis, my associate producer, Amy Jurevich, assistant producer Rachel Quimby, the All Sides interns Michael Hepburn, Shahina Sagiri, Abdulrahman Awu-Rayshan, and Ryan McFadden, with video production by Rich Karsmitsky and Amber Karsmitsky. Alan DeCenzo is the composer of our theme music. Be sure to like All Sides on Facebook and follow the show on Twitter at WOSU All Sides. You can follow me on Twitter too at Ann Fisher, WOSU. Thanks again for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.